on December 3rd, Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter and the Flesh Mapping Project held a press conference at the YWCA in downtown Vancouver. Quite a large number of press were there. Here's the recording.
You good to go?
Yeah.
So I'd like to start with Sheila Jeffries.
Yes, I'm Sheila Jeffries. I'm a professor of political science from the University of Melbourne and work on prostitution. And this is my latest book that came out 2 weeks ago, The Industrial Vagina, The Political Economy of the Global Sex Trade, in which I address lots of the issues that we've been talking about and are talking about here. Today I just want to give a few pieces of information about the situation with regard to legalised prostitution in Australia, because very often when the legalisation or decriminalisation of prostitution is considered, and I know there are some people considering that in Canada, the example of Australian states such as Victoria, where I come from, or New South Wales are given as good examples to follow. I have written considerably on what I call the failure of legalised prostitution in Australia. I look at all the reasons why governments suggested legalisation of prostitution was a good idea in the different states, and there are a variety of reasons. An important one is to control organised crime. Another is to prevent police corruption. Another is violence against women and trying to make women safer. And another is public health. In relation to all of these reasons for trying to control prostitution through legalization, the effects have been a massive failure. For instance, in my state of Victoria, it was certainly considered that legalizing brothel prostitution, which means that brothels have to get licenses, would control organized crime and get rid of the illegal industry. There are about 100 legal brothels in Victoria and an estimated 400 illegal brothels. The illegal sector is hugely larger, and that is the case everywhere where the legalization of prostitution occurs. So legalization only ever relates to a tiny proportion of the industry. This means that there's an enormous amount of council energy. They pay private detectives to go into brothels and try and ask for sex in order to try and go before magistrates and say brothels are illegal. The police have nothing to do with looking at brothels anymore or monitoring brothels, because one big concern was police corruption in relation to prostitution. So legalization takes off the hand of the police. The police have nothing to do with it. The local councils have all responsibility for trying to do anything about prostitution, and they're unable to. In relation to violence against women, the idea was that if women are taken into brothels, they will suffer less violence. The vast majority of women are not in brothels. They're in street prostitution and in the illegal prostitution. Street prostitution does not reduce with legalization. It remains the same, or in fact, it's grown very considerably in my state by about three times since legalization was originally introduced in the 1980s. But women who come into the brothels still suffer the everyday violence that's associated with prostitution. A very good guide to what happens in the brothels are the occupational health and safety codes, which are drawn up between the legalizing states and the sex workers' rights organizations in those states. In my state, the sex workers' rights organization was taken into the state government Department of Community Health, and it puts out safety sheets for prostituted women. For instance, I will give you a couple of gems. For instance, in relation to escort prostitution, because the terrible pain of prostitution is recognised, it suggested that women should use local anaesthetic in the vagina. It suggested that when they do use local anaesthetic in the vagina, they should be careful because it masks greater injuries. Women are told that when they approach a house for street prostitution, they have to ask for a tour so that they can find the exits. They must leave their clothes at the door because they shouldn't run out naked, and so on and so on. Legalizing brothel prostitution can do nothing about escort prostitution, which is incredibly, incredibly dangerous and is legalized in my state. in the state of Queensland, the information from the sex workers' rights organisation on safety suggests that if the client is getting very dangerous, it's important that the woman leaves, even though she'll lose the money, because the next day she cannot work with bruises. So basically what happens with legalisation is that the states become involved in the regulation of the violence, trying to lessen it a bit, but it goes on in the brothels because the ordinary use of women in prostitution is violent. I'll stop there for now.
Yes, I'm Young Suk Jo from Korea, and president of Center for Women's Human Rights. I came here because I heard that some Korean, actually, women trafficked into the Canada, and they tried to cross the border through Canada to the USA. So I wanted to know whether it's true or how many. Is that if there is any statistics or figures that you guys, your government or your state have. And also I wanted to share of my experience because what Professor Jeffrey said, the Korea also has the same situation since 40, 50 years. So even though the government criminalized prostitution, de facto situation in reality, the prostitution has legalized and tolerated and expanded every year. So up until almost year 2000, so almost at the minimum 330,000 women to 1 million women estimated involved in the sex industry in Korea. But what we haven't or didn't calculate is how many men actually involved with the prostitution. How many men every day they buy sex for or the purpose of sexual or their own desire, sexual desire. So we didn't have those figures and statistics, and whole society doesn't much have concern about how frequently, how many men actually buy sex. So we, women's group and society, started to reconsider the whole situation of prostitution related with the trafficking. After we started to research and we collect all the data and figures from all around the nation, so we noticed that prostitution are quite difficult to figure it out and distinguish with the trafficking. So we started to change our laws, and finally year 2000 we enacted the new law on prostitution. So we decided, whole society agreed upon to criminalize prostitution, especially procurers, that means pimps and the buyers. And also we drive to protect women in prostitution because they're victims of the sex industry and prostitution, and they've been exploited and they've been suffered from all their life when they started involved with the sex industry. So we started to change a whole system to protect the victims of prostitution. So I'm wondering whether the Canadian government or Canadian public concerns about how much the Canadian, demand the armed prostitution bring the overseas traffic to women in Canada, or the demand from the U.S., and how much the Canada actually misused as a place to disporting or cross the border through the USA or somewhere else. So I'm wondering, so I have questions for the Canada. How do you think and how do you actually want to make your own system and structures on prostitution and trafficking? Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jean Enriquez, Executive Director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Middle Asia Pacific. Today we join our sisters in Canada and other parts of the world in marking the 16 days of activism against violence against women. In the Philippines, we are campaigning for the passage of an anti-prostitution bill that will punish the buyers, but will protect the women and children that are victimized within the prostitution industry. We also hope that the anti-prostitution bill will continue to criminalize not only the syndicates, but also individuals that are taking advantage of the vulnerability of the women and the children that are trapped in prostitution. We feel that prostitution in the Philippines and many other poor countries in the world will get worse given the fiscal crisis that we are facing. We are anticipating that because the Philippines is one of the major suppliers of domestic workers and caregivers, not only to Canada but other places, that there will be a lot of them displaced, and many of them might be vulnerable to prostitution. We hold, of course, not only private corporations accountable, but also governments. Right now in the Philippines, farmers are also marching because of the loss of lands and the end of an agrarian reform program funding in the Philippines, which also means that more rural women will be are likely to be trafficked, which means also that a lot of them might be placed in prostitution. Already, 8 million Filipinos are overseas, are abroad. 74% of them are women. Most of them are in vulnerable situations, working as domestic helpers or caregivers. Also, I would like to cite that many of our places in the Philippines, especially ancestral lands of indigenous peoples, are being robbed by companies such as TVI, which is a Canadian mining firm that continues to exploit resources, especially in Western Mindanao, a Muslim populated area in the Philippines. And it has made many of the indigenous women vulnerable also, in fact, placed in prostitution in that place of our country. We would like to emphasize that prostitution, given all the circumstances that I mentioned, is not a choice for women. We know for a fact, because we work directly with victim survivors of prostitution, that more than 50% of them are victims of incestuous rape, of childhood sexual abuse. Given also the massive poverty that I have described very briefly, and also the militarism in our country, of course, this militarism not only coming from the U.S., but of course facilitated, assisted by arms manufacturers that are also based in Canada, also China, etc., are all creating conditions for the prostitution and trafficking of Filipino women, also other Asian women. It is not a choice because there's a demand that's being created by mining industries, by military institutions, other than the push factors that works against all the women. We believe that unless and until we condemn prostitution, not only trafficking as violence against women, this planet will never be a safe place for us, women and children.
Chairman? I'm Rani Sinha. I'm the founder member of Shonglab, an organization working in India, in Calcutta, but we are actually working in the South Asian region, particularly in the three countries, India, Bangladesh, and Nepal, because we need to know that there's a lot of trafficking of women from Bangladesh and Nepal into India, and of course now from India they are also going to the Middle East countries, mainly. There's a lot of trafficking across the borders, but what we try to ignore or not talk about is within the country trafficking, which leads to mainly prostitution in the country. The problems that we see over there is mainly the age of the women. I should call them children because all of them, more than 99%, start or are brought into it, forced into it, when they are children, when they are between the ages of 12 and 16. There's a lot of violence that we see in the brothel areas or in the in prostitution, and women get affected, and But we are continuously seeing that, you know, there is some kind of a support from the government to carry on with the brothels that exist over there. There are lots of cultural practices, you know, particularly the child marriage that happens in the rural India, which brings in, you know, is an issue or is the way to bring in a child from poor families or vulnerable families, and then they are sold into prostitution. There's a lot of unsafe migration in the name of labor within the country, and also from Nepal and Bangladesh, which brings young women, and then they are placed in houses where there is a lot of sexual abuse, physical abuse, and also they are sold into prostitution. Organized crime is one thing that has to go on if you have brothel prostitution, and it happens in our country also. There is a lot of abuse in the name of control of the brothel owners, of the pimps, and of the brothel managers. And though we discuss, you know, because there is this discussion of legalizing brothels in India, we discuss that, you know, women will have agency, but we know that, all these women will remain poor, as is the experience in other places also. I should particularly mention the use of HIV/AIDS money to keep on the brothels, because that is one thing that is being promoted by our government. And this HIV/AIDS money mainly comes from United States, from the UNAIDS, and also from Bill Gates Foundation. We will continue to have vulnerable women or vulnerable girl children looking for jobs or getting into marriage from the rural areas of Bangladesh, Nepal, and India. And they will be coming to the cities in search of job or in search of a partner, and they will be, because there is lack of information and lack of choice, they will get into prostitution. So on one hand, our government is trying to create more and more care and protection places for the children who are trafficked, or children or young women who are rescued from prostitution. But on the other hand, they continue to have the brothels go on, and you know, not protest, you know, when legalization of prostitution is being called for. Thank you.
Can I just ask her to clarify one thing she said before we move to the video? I don't understand the point you were making about the money coming from the U.S. and the Bill Gates Foundation. Something you think?
Bill Gates Foundation funds the HIV/AIDS programs, and it comes to the health ministry. So through the government, they want that money to be coming in. So it is used in the brothels. They want the brothels because they say that if the brothels are closed down, that all these women are going to go underground, so we won't be able to treat them for HIV/AIDS. So in that way, they want the brothels to keep on going, and a lot of money is being funded to keep on the brothels.
Is there any evidence that the existence
My name is Lee Lakeman. I'm a member of the collective at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, but I also speak for the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers. The rape crisis centers across the country in the last few years have been discussing with each other that the situation of prostitution in Canada has changed for the worse. And there are several elements to that change. We can identify, and did identify as rape crisis centers, that about 1995, the economic conditions for women started to change dramatically. And we actually have confirmed in our conversations yesterday, our international conversations, that there was a significant swing to the right which affected women's issues pretty much around the Pacific Rim. It's very interesting how often that date came up between us. But partly what we're identifying is what the United Nations has identified this week, actually, last week, that Canada's failure to deliver welfare or any kind of guaranteed social economic level to the Women of Canada as a significant player in the violence against women that we're observing. Excuse me. The UN has recently criticized Canada for its failure to deliver those welfare services, and it also criticized Canada for its failure to deal with the violence against Indigenous women, the violence against Aboriginal women, and has in fact been so critical that it demands Canada must answer up within a year with a proper investigation for what's happened in that situation. We know in this city that there is a relationship between the promotion of prostitution and the promotion of tolerance of the violence against Indigenous women. So that's one of the things that my association is serious and trying to address, the relationship between racism, colonialism, and prostitution. We're also very concerned about the failure to actually use the state power to protect women from violence against women, and the UN has criticized that as well. We don't have enough services. We don't have a serious criminal justice response to violence against women. Whether that violence is wife assault, incest, violence on the street, is in some ways irrelevant. But once you've declared prostitution violence against women, as we have, it's then important that all the state responses to violence against women improve. It's necessary that women be able to get a police response with an effective investigation and an effective prosecution of the men committing violence against women. Right now, there are laws against prostitution that are simply not enforced against the behavior of men. It is illegal to procure. It is illegal to run a brothel. It is illegal to buy women. And the fact that men are getting away with it is an indictment against our government. We wanted particularly to draw attention to the fact that Vancouver cannot exempt itself from the responsibility for global trafficking. Being a port city, being an international airport city, being on the American border puts us in a very particular position. So the Rape Crisis Center in Vancouver has intentionally invited women from around the Pacific Rim to share our understanding of what is the relationship between men buying women in downtown Vancouver or in the Lower Mainland and the trafficking of women around the Pacific Rim. We knew that we had too little information, but we do have some information. It's common knowledge that the majority of women in the illegal brothels in the Lower Mainland are Asian women. It's common knowledge. It's common knowledge that who's being attacked in prostitution on the street are Aboriginal women. It's common knowledge. And it's common knowledge that the men who buy these women are walking away from social responsibility for it. But also currently our civic government, our provincial government, and our federal government are walking away from that responsibility. So we've decided to do what women always have to do, which is increase our direct action. So we're building coalition around the Pacific Rim. We intend to continue building these coalitions, and we intend to continue to find ways to strategize against the oppressive behavior of men in this industry. We know we're looking at the growing of the trade, purposeful growing of the trade, as the Olympics approaches. There is an inseparable relationship between sex tourism and prostitution, between tourism and prostitution, and we intend to actually work as hard as we can against those forces right now, because the relationship between my freedom on the street of Vancouver and the freedom of the Asian women who are being trafficked here, or the Indigenous women who are being lured here from the north, is a relationship that is simply can't be tolerated.
Questions now? I have a question for Lee. Lee, how is prostitution being sort of purposefully grown in anticipation of the Olympics? Like, what do you see that alarms you at this point, and what do you anticipate?
I don't think it's possible to consider that the public debate that we're having doesn't also work as promotion for the industry. So here we are, far and wide, women are calling for a response to what's happened to the Indigenous women, and the government does nothing. It pretty much tells men around the world, if you want to buy women, you can drop into Vancouver. Clearly tolerating the illegal brothels, which is a flagrant misapplication of the law, says something. It says something. And for liberals to go about debating this as though women's lives were not at stake is nonsense.
And as brothels, you're referring to the massage parlors that employ a lot of Asian women?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to actually get clear about all the definitions. We have asked City Hall for a list of who's licensed. We got, for instance, a short list of who are licensed as escort services in Vancouver. But you do, when you press that, even with the Freedom of Information Act, which we have, you do not get a full list of what the city knows or what the city's policies are. So I urge you, why don't you find out what's going on here in the relationship to City Hall? We know, for instance, from our little investigation that some escort services are listed under multiple names, and that's so that they can promote a racist invitation by several different racist names. You approach City Hall and find out. They'll go to the length of getting five different licenses in order to be able to say the name in five different racist ways to appeal to this kind of woman or to sell this kind of woman or this kind of woman or this kind of woman. That's one example. But, I think we're dealing with prostitution on a massive level now, massive level, and inseparable from the question of trafficking.
And explain a little bit how you say local demand here makes more trafficking from Asian countries.
Sure, I think there's a number of women who could speak to that, but the nature of the sexist abuse in prostitution is that men require constant change. So you always have to invent a new product. And the woman is the product. So after a while, she's tiresome, and it's necessary to get new ones. So you're constantly feeding that cyclical trade in women when you tolerate men buying women in the Vancouver area and the Lower Mainland area. And we know that that's, clearly the numbers are escalating. And we know that women are being brought in from various parts of the world, always. And vividly clear in our discussion is, it's the poorest parts of the world. It's the poorest parts of the world. Those women are being served up to the men of the Lower Mainland. But other women can probably respond to that.
I was just going to ask, the provincial office that was created to in trafficking, can you say something about the government and the police response to either about trafficking?
Absolutely. Vancouver Rape Relief has been cooperating with the Provincial Office Against Trafficking in Women, and we're hopeful that there will be some government responses. At the moment, that office has very little money, very little power, very few resources. Nonetheless, it's trying to make some kind of effort there. But what you need to realize is we have a growing history of mistreatment of trafficked women now. So to start with the international scene, I'm sure many of you were as moved as I was by the Fujian women who were dumped off our coasts, some of them actually literally dumped into the cold waters off the coast. And when the government met with them, actually had to face that there were these trafficked peoples, some of them trafficked for labor, but many of them trafficked for sexual purposes. Those people were jailed. That was our government's response, to jail the trafficked people, the trafficked women in that case. And Rape Relief got very involved at that moment because we housed some of those women. So we've been involved in a discussion with the government ever since about the appropriate treatment of trafficked peoples. We have a law that says the government is supposed to protect trafficked women, but in fact it has failed to actually prosecute successfully any traffickers. It has absolutely failed to provide protection to trafficked women. The pretense that we protect women is absolutely unsupportable. Similarly, we know that women are trafficked from the northern parts of the province, some directly trafficked with guns, with real force, some of them, who are starved into it or lured into it, and who are abandoned in the downtown east side. And when you don't have welfare and you don't have a way out, you don't have exit services, you don't have detox services, we can easily say the government is maintaining those women in a situation of compulsory prostitution.
And what do you recommend? What do you want to change for the situation to get better?
The Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers has a 5-point plan at this point. The first one is to recognize that domestic prostitution is violence against women, and to immediately insist that the government decriminalize the women who are prostituted and continue to criminalize, but effectively criminalize, the men who buy women, buy sex, the men who procure, and the men who run brothels and trafficking and prostitution institutions. But also, we have to deal with poverty. It's an inseparable issue from poverty. And so the level of welfare or the move toward a guaranteed livable income is an essential move, as the UN is saying. Clearly, we have to have better response to all forms of violence against women. We've all lived through Picton. We've all lived through multiple violent attackers. And we know the level of failure of the criminal justice system in wife assault. We have to have a better response. But also, clearly, we have to recognize that prostitution is related to third world politics. It's related to global politics and racism. And so there has to be a relationship to how Canada as a country responds to Indigenous peoples and to third world debt, for instance. It's just inseparable from these issues. You can hear the indictment of Canadian corporations. We've had a lot of talk in the last few days about the direct relationship between military bases and the proliferation of prostitution, which is a new question for Canada. It's a growing question for Canada now. So,
can you put a number at all to either how many sex trade workers we may have right now, either in Vancouver or the Lower Mainland, and or how many brothels under any kind of definition we might have? I mean, you indicated that it's a growing thing, but can we put numbers on it?
Well, I can tell you that we run one tiny little rape crisis center, and I have never seen a week in the life of that rape crisis center when there wasn't a woman trying to escape prostitution. And that number is growing, growing and growing and growing. We are beyond our capacity to deal with the number of women who are trying to escape and cannot. And I'm constantly now faced with very young women with young babies who have no other economic option. So it's enormous. It's enormous. The government will admit to hundreds of women being trafficked. I dare say we're into thousands. Trafficked across international borders. There's no question that the decimation of Indigenous communities we're all watching. You can drive around the downtown east side and see the numbers of women who are trapped.
So the women that you are struggling to help, they are coming from, their backgrounds are from many different countries. They come,
yes.
They have a very varied age range.
Yes.
Are you also seeing an increase in younger women?
Yes.
I just want to give Lee's voice a break. It's cracking all over the place. Do I have questions for any of the other panelists? There was one for Rani that I interrupted. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask what the government rationale is for directing HIV/AIDS money to the brothels, and is there any indication that it is helping to slow the infection rate?
Actually, that's the idea. I mean, to slow the process or, you know, have more awareness in those areas. Maybe there is more awareness in the area, but actually, you know, what we are trying to tell the government is that HIV/AIDS information need to go to every household, every woman who has a husband who is migrating, working outside, going to prostitutes, because men are the buyers of prostitutes. So HIV/AIDS money should go over there also, where we have very little, you know, apart from a few advertisements which mostly women in rural areas won't see. We don't have much money going there. But you have continuously, you see that lot of money, you know, there are clinics for these women who are in prostitution, there are free condoms for women who are in prostitution, hospitalization if needed for women in prostitution, as if HIV/AIDS doesn't exist anywhere else. But in some of their own, I mean, the medical college in Calcutta did a survey where it was found that more women who are in the homes, in the secured places, are HIV positive compared to the women who are in prostitution, and that is not because the women in prostitution are aware about it now. It is, I mean, before that it was done. And this strange idea of that keeping the brothels will mean that the women will be there, so you know they will be made aware or they will be given a condom. That is, I think, the only reason, you know, why they are doing it. I mean, that's what they are showing. But on the other hand, there are, as I said already, that lot of care and protection places, you know, for victims of prostitution. So the government knows very well that there are victims of prostitution. There are children who are coming into it, are being tricked into it and forced into it. But at the same time, they don't close it. And keeping the brothels on means that, you know, more and more pimps are going to use it and bring young children, because that is the demand for the men, young children in prostitution.
If I could just make a connection to Vancouver, part of what we're beginning to discuss is what are commonly called harm reduction strategies that we're recognizing are in fact maintaining harm-producing situations, and so that you grow an industry that appears to be about protecting people, but in fact is deeply entrenched in the maintenance of the situation. So it's not that we wouldn't want AIDS money to go to all kinds of places, but the question is, why are the situations being maintained? Why are we not interfering with the root causes of the things that will actually make a difference? In Vancouver, for instance, there's the great debate about the injection site. I mean, of course, all of us want people who are already addicted to be protected, but we need to also get about the business of reducing the drug trade. And the analogy is similar in prostitution. We want not to be just patching over the consequences. We want women not to be prostituted and not to be put in the position of risking their lives in the first place.
I have one question for Jean and Rita. I don't know in the Philippines if you've heard of any women being trafficked in Canada or in other countries, or if you think that the economic situation will push women, maybe not knowingly for prostitution, but thinking, oh, I'm offered a better life, I will go, and then something happens.
Yeah, Filipino women are trafficked everywhere. If we're going to do a mapping, as is the intention of this project, yeah, it will be red dots all over. Even within the Philippines itself, internal trafficking for prostitution is so rampant that almost every place is a source, transit, and destination, which also means men all over are like, I'm not saying all men, but most men in all places are consuming, buying women in prostitution. And definitely, as I described, poverty is a major push factor, but also other forms of violence against women. As I mentioned earlier, strikingly in our shelter, 90% of the women are, at least those who have testified, are victims of childhood sexual abuse. So it's undeniable that there is a very direct link between the attacks that they have suffered early in childhood, for them to be vulnerable to prostitution. In the words of one survivor that I myself am counseling, says that since I'm being used by my father on a daily basis, then why not accept a 500 pesos being offered by a pimp in exchange for the same use that I'm experiencing daily? And she doesn't understand love, she doesn't understand affection, etc., those things, because she has been socialized into thinking that that's love, the way she was being abused, and that's being suffered by so many women. We have been discussing in the past few days how strongly young women are being socialized into accepting that abuse is okay, that it's part of our identity as women, as women or as girls. And I think it's as strong as poverty. While it's true that poverty is a very strong force, I wouldn't trivialize or I wouldn't diminish the role of culture, of media, of desexualizing pop culture that's being experienced not only by women of the South, but strongly here of the North as well. We are also receiving MTV from the US and everywhere, and they have the same messages for women to be always sexually available to men. So I would like to emphasize that yes, poverty, but also this very sexualized culture that tells all of us women that for you to be a real woman, you have to be sexually available. And we're experiencing it on a daily basis, from sexual harassment to rape, etc. So that's very connected to prostitution as well. I would just like to make a very quick comment on HIV as well, because in the Philippines, there's also very huge money being put into it. And as Lee mentioned, and also Indrani B, that unless and until there's a critique of prostitution as violence against women, all HIV/AIDS efforts are only meant to cleanse the women.
Yeah.
For the benefit of the men.
Yeah.
It's not about the women, because the women that we are counseling on a daily basis are suffering from anemia that borders on leukemia, on tuberculosis, on lung cancer, etc. And there are no services for this. What we want is holistic women's care, not only for their physical health, but their complete well-being. And the wounds that are not seen on our skin are even deeper and very difficult to heal, and that's not being answered by HIV/AIDS. One more thing, one survivor from the Philippines was made to swallow a condom at gunpoint because she was insisting to the customer that she use a condom, that he use a condom. And that's not possible within prostitution. There's no equal power relations within prostitution. Women can never negotiate with men, not even within marriage at all times. Women are being raped, and it's really a fallacy to believe that this HIV/AIDS advocacy will work without a critique of gender violence.
Can you just say something about HIV?
Can you just expand on the flesh mapping, what you're doing, and what you're hoping to accomplish at this conference?
Yeah, we're trying to look at relationships, as Lee described, among countries and also powers within northern countries and southern countries, the powers of corporations over and above the people, of states as well, and how all these factors are contributing to trafficking and prostitution. How these factors correlate with the presence of trafficking and prostitution industries as well. So we see already, from our long histories, first stories of fighting trafficking and prostitution, there's a very direct correlation between the presence of military bases, for instance, mining industries, concentrations of men, and even individual men, to the proliferation of trafficking and prostitution.
You say a military base, you mean in your country or in Canada or
everywhere?
One of the things we've done is literally,
Okinawa
was a really clear example.
Peacekeepers in East Timor from Australia, right. UN peacekeepers parked outside the brothels that they've created there that have Chinese trafficked women. They're parked 24 hours a day. So peacekeeper prostitution is a huge issue now internationally.
One of the things we've literally done is make a map of where bases are and where the trafficking routes are that we know of. And they overlap, of course. And then they're followed up immediately afterwards by tourism routes, which are the same routes to the same places. So it's layer on layer on layer of the incursion around the Pacific.
I wanted to ask anyone on the panel, actually. Now, Canada has now prosecuted, I think, 2 sex tourists.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you see that now that we have laws against sex tourism, should there be a greater effort to, and how much of an issue is this?
Actually, it doesn't necessarily need to mention only the Canadian demand the prostitution. So globalization in this kinds of world, everybody goes everywhere. So for example, Korean male businessmen come to Vancouver and demand for some, maybe the Canadian women or the Korean girls in here. So it brings another different kinds of types of, you know, demands. So it comes not start from here, but it comes from Korea, but it happened in Vancouver. It's possible. So all these kinds of similar demanding circulated, and it's made a kind of, you know, ancient Silk Road kinds of demands road in the world. So all prostitution followed all, you know, different types of trips and tours, you know, goes. So we, the reason why we are here and, you know, decided to discuss about the flesh mapping is we need to figure it out and follow and monitor what's going on and what's happening. So through the Pacific Rim, so wherever it starts from coast, it starts everywhere and it goes everywhere. So we need to figure it out, the whole roads and whole, you know, map. So mapping of the demands and how the trafficking and prostitution goes and follow the all demands is, I think it's quite important, and I think the Vancouver initiative these kind of ideas and this kind to have to find out the resolutions, to find out, you know, better solutions. I think it's quite good ideas and good initiatives. So
I'll take two more questions.
The one thing I would add to that is that the cases that have come up so far, such as the Backer case, which were very important in Vancouver for what they reveal. Backer, you should notice, was the first case that was promoted as being a case about sex tourism abroad. However, what actually he was caught doing was torturing Aboriginal women in the downtown East Side. And it's the fact that he was caught with an adult prostitute, prostituted woman, who he was literally torturing with electrodes. When they caught him, they discovered that he had a load of videotapes of his abuse of children in Asia. And the court case actually develops from all of that. And it should be noted that his defense in the case of his torture of the indigenous woman was that he had negotiated for violent sex, and that was actually raised as a discussion point in court. So it's a case that actually shows us all the facets of the trade, that you can't separate child prostitution from what's going on with young adults. You can't separate what's going on in the abuse of women in the downtown East Side from what's going on with the abuse of children in Asia. These are related, and they're related by the behavior of the men, and that's what we have to get at, the behavior of the men that must be effectively criminalized and must be, from which women must be protected.
So I'll take two last questions.
I just want to ask Shayla, you're likely aware that we have some politicians in Canada and also some women who work in the sex industry who are advocates for some form of decriminalization or the establishment of legal brothels. Their argument is what's working now clearly isn't working because of the violence, because of the increasing number of women we see working here. How do you respond to that from what you've witnessed in Australia? I mean, can their argument have any validity that, you know, keeping it illegal isn't working and we should be trying something new?
The problem is that the main difficulty you seem to have here is violence against street prostituted women, particularly against Aboriginal women and street prostitution. That won't be affected at all by the legalization of some brothels. It cannot be. Aboriginal women, for instance, because of particular kinds of racism, are not usually in brothels and certainly licensed brothels. So those women will be just as violent and there will be just as many deaths. Legalized prostitution normalizes prostitution generally, so you'll get far more men involved. We presently have 16% of men in apparently using women in prostitution in Australia. You'll get far 16. More. Yeah, you'll get far more with legalization because it's normalized, so there will be more violence against women in various kinds of prostitution. Escort prostitution is unaffected by legalization. It's legalized here. And it's an extremely dangerous form of prostitution. So you already have legalization of some sectors and de facto legalization because there's acceptance and toleration of massage parlors. So very little that is different will happen. If we just talk for a moment about public health in the brothels, the occupational health and safety codes in Australia make it clear how extremely difficult it is for women to operate condom codes, even though the legalization legislation suggests that this should happen. The instructions say, for instance, that the erection is crucial. They must not affect the man's erection or they'll lose the booking, right? Yep. So they've somehow got to both keep themselves safe and stop the man doing things and also keep a condom on.
without upsetting his erection. They are advised to reach behind themselves during the act of sexual intercourse, penis in vagina sex, to see if the condom is still on, without upsetting the man, because the men pull the condoms off. If the man knows they're checking to see if the condom is on, he will beat them up. So getting a condom on in the first place is extremely difficult, because if the women really need the money, they will do sex without condoms. The men damage condoms and pull them off. The idea that you can actually make what is an act of abuse into something which is reasonable in a brothel is it is impossible to imagine. It's very difficult to imagine that any other kind of work that men do could be accepted with these extraordinary risks. The risks of prostitution are not just pain in the vagina, they're unwanted pregnancies, they're the need for abortion, there's sexually transmitted diseases which can cause terrible health problems throughout the women's lives, there's psychological trauma and distress, because the insides of their bodies and very vulnerable mucous membranes are the heart of this work. And nothing can be done about that through legalization. All of those risks remain.
So if the legislation is not the way we are going, so what we should do, what do you think we should do?
What you should do is you should penalize the clients in prostitution, as in the Swedish model, and you should decriminalize the women. In Sweden, there's an estimated 600 women in prostitution with a population of about 9 million. This is a very low number. Because in other countries, in countries that have legalized, such as Germany, there's an estimated 300,000 prostituted women. In Britain, which tolerates massage parlors, as you do, there are an estimated 80,000 prostituted women. And in both Germany and in Britain, 75 to 80% of these women are reckoned to be in debt bondage. So Sweden has actually really dealt with this problem to a very, very large extent. It has discouraged trafficking, and it has certainly lowered the numbers of women in prostitution. And 80% of the people, the citizens in Sweden, support that law. Cultural change is crucial. The politicians will go with where they think the vote is. You have to change the culture of these patriarchal societies, as has been done in Sweden, to accept that this abuse of women is not consonant with gender equality. And that can be done. Obviously, in the patriarchal society of Australia and of Canada and the patriarchal politics of Canada, you are not at that stage. You are still thinking, some people are still thinking in Canada, that that states should regulate this violence, that they should actually accept it and regulate it for its male citizens.
Sorry, did you give a number of the estimated prostitution rate in Sweden? I think
there's an estimated 600 women in prostitution in Sweden. Tiny, tiny, tiny numbers. And 80% of the population supports that men should be penalised for buying women. It's a very, very gender-equal society compared with others around the world. And that is why they have that excellent legislation.
And we should celebrate the fact that Norway has just passed similar law. And both Norway and Sweden are considerably above Canada in the list of the index. It's the name of the index. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of a press conference held by the Flesh Mapping Project. The Flesh Mapping Project is meeting from 2 to 4 each day through December 10th at the Vancouver Art Gallery. For more information, Google Flesh Mapping Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter.